This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 16th of August 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 319 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards.
The sights, sounds and tastes of the summer explored and celebrated today will kick off with a very special guest for you, none other than British DJ and music icon Norman Jay, king of the Carnival Festival establishment. His music spans house, funk, jazz, funk, soul and plenty more besides. We'll be getting the insights of this legend of the good times in just a moment.
Then we'll be crossing the ocean and hearing from New Yorker magazine writer and successful author William Finnegan as he finishes a book on his true passion, surfing. What is it about the waves that makes the surfer's heart beat faster? And why is surfing so much more than just a sport? We'll be finding out with William.
And as we're in the height, but not necessarily heat of the summer, we'll be discovering the trends and culture of one of the season's most vital components, Steve, you'd agree. Beer, ale, craft, wheat and more from East London to Germany. We'll be getting hoppy with beer connoisseur Pete Brown.
That's all coming up. Plus, Danny Giacopelli will be here with the coming week's news, and there'll be some music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
What a week it's been, Steve.
It has.
The height of British summer.
Basically, if you aren't listening in the UK, congratulations, because your weather was probably normal, as was, let's face it, not really August, was it?
It was modest. It was moist.
Yes.
And those are just words that start with M and end in T.
Indeed. It's basically been pouring down all week, as it should do, I guess, like one week every summer, because otherwise it wouldn't be a British summer.
Quite.
And we've got a show which is sort of slightly, I'd say sort of British summer themed.
Yeah, it's summery.
To an extent. We've got Norman Jay's going to be here. Very much looking forward to that. Surfing, is that a sort of British? Well, you can do that in summer and not very well.
Down in Cornwall.
Yeah, Newquay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you're a surfer, I wouldn't suggest Britain is the best place
Possibly
to do
not.
It.
But there'll be sort of sunshine hues on
And
that.
Then also, that most British of drinks, beer.
I mean, beer is fine all year round, as I'm sure Pete Brown would be very keen for us to point out.
Indeed. Now, Andrew Tuck is not here this week. He's had a little holiday, a little sort of a Swiss holiday. And Mr. Robert Bound is sort of here and not here this week.
You'll be hearing from Rob in this episode of the weekly.
I'm slightly annoyed about that because I wanted to do the beer tasting, but it seems that Rob has...
We beat you to the punch on that one. But we're going to be talking to Norman in a moment or two. But before we even consider speaking to Norman, there's someone else we need to hear from.
Is there? Who's that?
I'm afraid it's Daniel Giacopelli.
Danny, there's no other but Danny. There's a lover, my Danny, and I love him more each day.
The thing that worries me about that song is that he's now made it his mobile ringtone. And I sit opposite him.
No, actually,
so every now and then, on the rare occasions when someone actually calls Danny, I hear that.
That's how I wake up in the morning. It's my new alarm clock.
That's absolutely terrifying. Though I like the fact that you added your own personal hand clap.
Feel like I was clapping?
Yeah. It goes with your sort of...
It'll never get old.
Your greasy leather jacketed 50s look that you've got going.
Not okay.
He has actually, hasn't he?
Yeah.
It's the beard as well.
Yeah. I've grown a beard. I'm just telling the world.
Groom it like that. It's really off-putting. Let's move on.
I'm so glad to have a webcam.
Exactly. Webcam people would just be nauseous the world over. Now, Danny, where should we start? What have you got for us? What's happening this week?
Let's start in Brazil. Today, there's quite a large anti-government demonstration taking place. A lot of people don't like the current leader, Dilma Rousseff, at the moment.
A lot of corruption scandals. I think currently 93% of people don't like
it. It's a shockingly low approval rate.
That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
I think
is it 93 or 92? I'd seen 8%.
I've seen seven and falling.
Oof.
Which is, you're almost, once you've almost got to be impressed by that.
Once you've sort of counted your family, your friends,
Fernando,
people who are on your payroll, that's pretty much it, isn't it? It's pretty, but these are, I mean, and yeah, potentially pretty big events. We'll be picking over the bones of the protests later on our Globalist show on Monday morning as well. So people should
we will indeed
to that.
Tomorrow there's an election in Sri Lanka. We'll also be covering that on Monocle 24. I think that's That's probably all we need for the serious stuff at the moment, right?
Oh, you've really changed the weighting of this item.
So,
to go delve right into what really matters.
Today, the Palio di Siena, the famous, I'm probably saying that completely wrong despite studying Italian, but it's a large, very famous, very historical horse race in Siena in Italy.
This is incredible.
And this is the big one.
And this is life and limb risked by, you know, riders, horses, everyone alike.
The horses aren't really risking anything. They're kind of forced to do this.
They're being forced to risk everything.
They're forced to risk everything. But it can be quite a bloodbath. But it's an extraordinary event.
Have you gone?
Is this one that goes through the streets of Siena?
No, it goes throughout the Campia, the Campo, rather, their main piazza. It's kind of an oval-shaped thing. Right?
I think there might be some kind of procession to get there. And then the mayhem unfolds on this thing. It's pretty extraordinary to watch. I've only seen it on film. I haven't been there in person.
Yeah, it's been going since 1656. The first one, 1656 or 1700, one of the two.
Are you reading this in Italian? Is that your problem here?
Oh yeah, that's my problem. It's some weird dialect of Italian I'm not really comfortable with. So
I think that's just Italian.
Not the one that I'm... yeah.
Normal
it's not,
Italian.
It's not Italian-American, that's why you can't read it. What else has caught your eye?
International Orangutan Day.
Hey, really?
I love an orangutan.
On the 19th?
I love an orangutan.
And what happens on International Orangutan
the
Day?
The Sumatran...
Do we get to bring our orangutans to work?
I don't know, but you know...
Steve, I've spoken to you before. You're not allowed to keep those in your basement.
I think it means...
If I can bring them to work, that's surely fine.
Tom, you were telling me before you know what that word means.
Orangutan, I believe, means old man of the forest.
Completely wrong,
I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Can we Google that?
Do write in to Danny if that's wrong.
We could have easily checked that,
fact-checked that before we came on.
I'm
pretty sure it means old man of the forest, yeah.
They do look like old men that live in forests.
Yeah.
That's probably where it comes from.
There's a kind of truth in that. There we go.
Who would have thought?
Steve, have you ever thought about being a detective or something? Because keen eye
for stating the obvious detective. Yeah.
Coincidentally.
I feel like there aren't enough TV detectives who merely just state the obvious. Oh, he's dead.
D.I. Bloomfield investigates. I can see a franchise rolling out.
I think that could work.
What else is happening, Danny?
Was that my theme tune you were singing?
Yeah, I kind of ripped it off of CSI. SVU. The controversial Slovenian rock group, Laibach.
I hate them.
Well, guess they're going to be you probably pissed off a lot of people right now, but they're going to be the first band from overseas to perform in North Korea.
Ah, I know exactly who you're talking about.
Yes.
Sorry, I was just because you said
that hated
controversial.
Some
I was like, oh, yes, I hate that controversial group. But yeah, these are the
foreigners, guys
who are going to North Korea.
Indeed.
Who have a slightly totalitarian-esque appearance, don't they?
Yes, but some people say that that's actually a critique of totalitarian-esque ideology.
I see. So they're sort of trying to bring it down from the inside. It's one of those.
Yeah.
So I may look like a fascist, but I'm merely mocking the fascist look.
I think that's probably the real thing. So they're going to play hits from their 35-year career. And also North Korean folk songs are going to be playing.
Wow.
We'll see how this goes down.
Where is this happening, Danny? In Pyongyang?
I assume it's some grand venue.
I think this is a thing that's being organised by some Norwegian guy.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Some kind of like soft power diplomacy kind of thing?
It's all a little bit surreal.
Yeah.
Sounds kind of amazing. I mean,
yeah,
it'd be a great show.
I mean, I don't know whether it's going to be quite as dramatic as Dennis Rodman, sort of.
Yeah. It's got some way to go to live up to that.
Rocking up there, but we will see. Will this be broadcast live on North Korean TV?
Don't know. I would assume. One would assume there's lots of shots of Kim Jong-un pointing at them or something like that.
Or laughing. He more does the laughing thing than the standing and pointing.
He does some pointing though.
His dad was sort of, more of a stand and pointer.
I also saw this week that he has taken to wearing his father's sunglasses. There's been photos this week of him wearing a very particular brand of sunglasses, and now he's wearing them.
Do you think he just had like a really heavy night? I was like, oh God, I've got to go and point at things and
laugh. Where's dad's glasses?
I'll wear dad's glasses.
Yeah. I'll skip over National Potato Day because that's kind of a UK thing, but we'll go straight to the...
Where are you finding these stories? Have you just...
Journalism.
Put national and day in Google.
I don't think this can count as journalism, Danny.
The 19th, though, National Potato Day.
We'll move on from that.
Okay, the World Science Fiction Convention is taking place in Washington. This is actually a big deal on the 19th. It's the world's largest science fiction convention. that's all I got to say about that.
You really bring the stories to life.
Lots of sci-fi fans will be there. It's a convention.
Here's one for you, Danny. If you were to attend a sci-fi convention, you got to put your little outfit on. What would you dress? I think you could dress as an Ewok.
Han Solo. No doubt about it.
I think Ewok is actually quite a good call, particularly with that beard.
Yeah.
You
look a bit like Wiccan.
No, don't stroke it again.
Maybe Obi-Wan. Or
definitely not
some kind of obscure character from the Dune series.
I like how he's trying to sound as if he's quite cool.
Isaac Asimov.
What's he got?
You can't say that on radio.
Okay, one more left to go. Europe's largest bird watching fair is on the 21st.
Wow, where's this taking place?
Rutland, wherever the hell that is.
Rutland, wherever the hell that is.
Yeah, I don't venture beyond London. I assume it's in the UK somewhere.
It is in the UK somewhere.
That's correct.
The Eagleton Nature Reserve. A varied range of lectures, I've been told, will happen there, including an exhibition. It's the 27th annual one, but it's Europe's largest birdwatching fair.
Twitchers of Europe unite.
The largest gathering of ornithologists.
Are you a bit of a twitcher, Danny?
That's, I don't know what that means, but it sounds
I think that
variously,
that means something really different.
Lots of innuendos.
Does it? There's no innuendo there.
I don't think so. Yeah. Well, it sounds like it could be something
it's unsavory. A very straight question. Yeah. Do you twitch?
I tweak now and then.
You tweak?
Twerk, rather.
I wonder what you're tweaking.
Well, this is
tweak actually means something not good, as people probably...
Should I don't know about you, Steve, but I feel like drawing a veil over this item.
I feel we should just move on. I think there's some...
That's all I've got, though.
I was going to say thanks to Danny, but frankly, no. It's probably best just to shepherd him out of the studio with nothing more said.
Should we just have a bit of silence?
Yeah.
Now, as we promised at the top of the show, we are joined today by a legend of music. Born in London's Notting Hill when the area was as deprived as it was ethnically diverse, Norman Jay and his Good Times Party became an establishment within the famous Notting Hill Carnival, his float attracting up to 15,000 revellers at a time. Norman was also a pioneer of pirate and then mainstream radio disc jockeying and the fanzine movement before that.
However, times are a-changing, and London, like perhaps no other city, moves rapidly through cycles of social and cultural change. The club cultures, the music scenes, even the carnival itself are all very different now to when Norman started out. Above all, the urban makeup of London has changed radically, with Notting Hill, the former Afro-Caribbean heartland of the capital, now becoming largely an area for the super rich.
To discuss all this and why actually he won't be attending this year's carnival, we're delighted to be joined in the studio by Norman Jay himself.
Norman Jay, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to have you.
Thanks for inviting me.
now tell me, it's hard to know it at times from being out and about in the City of London when it's grey and overcast, but how's London summer been treating you?
Well, it's non-existent, really.
Only this week,
yeah,
with the rain.
Harking back to days of yore, I've experienced three, maybe four seasons in the space of 24 hours. One learns to live with that. So I'm not one of these sort of perennial people that go on about the weather. It is what it is. If you want somewhere hot, go somewhere hot. Back in the day, you know, a day or so before Notting Hill Carnival, hoping it would be warm, not too hot, just warm.
Just warm enough.
Yes.
Just warm enough for a
Because
good,
I found
day.
That, you know, the hotter it is, the more it slows people down.
And is carnival still something you look forward to every year?
Hand on heart, no.
Is that because you got older, or you think the whole thing has changed somewhat?
It's changed quite a lot. And my own personal view is that I don't really see a long-term future for my sound system at carnival. So being preemptive and looking for past is new.
Mm. Why do you think that is, Norman? What's changing then? Is it just the old stories about, you know, the affluent moving into West London? Is it something more fundamental than that?
It's all of that. But I guess, you know, all good things come to an end. You know, when my brother and my friends first came to Notting Hill in 1980, it was off the back of the 1976 riots in the area. Very dark days. It was the Wild West. Those days, carnival would start about 3 o'clock on a Thursday morning and end, you know, 1 a.m. on Tuesday morning. Obviously, those dark days have long since passed. And it's an amazing event. I can truly say that from my perspective, from Good Times. You know, we've helped in a very positive way put it on the map. But like I said, all good things come to an end. We're basically like a Premiership football club. Without a home ground, without a home stadium. And for whatever reasons, you know, the local authorities and the powers that be haven't or have been unable to or unwilling to even, you know, help relocate us. So while they're dragging their feet, I'm not going to drag mine. I looked at our record. We've had a 30-odd year. Fantastic time there, unblemished safety record, built it into something huge from the days when that postcode used to be somewhere even postmen feared to tread. You know, we've put it on the international festival map. it was, and perhaps still is, the last great London street party. When in this day and age, when festivals are the norm, you pay for festivals, you pay for mud, you pay for everything. Carnival was still free at point of entry. The downside of that was that the participants, the sound systems, the mass bands and all of that, funded it themselves. So basically London was enjoying a huge free party, still is, at the cost to us. And that was an unworkable financial model for us. Unable to attract sponsorship, even though sponsors were falling over themselves to get involved with good times, because, you know, everybody could see, you know, from the photographs, thanks to the internet, it's the greatest living Coca-Cola advert. There's every colour face there. There's every sexual persuasion there. There's every hue there. No festival in the UK, not even Glastonbury, can boast that. And that was one of the great things that worked for us. But again, it was a very confined space, 4 square miles of Victorian London. There was the whole gentrification thing, but, you know, I was born in Notting Hill. I was born less than, you know, half a mile from where I played. So I'm more than qualified, the most, to comment on it. You know, when I was born, when I lived there, it was a ghetto area. But one could see by the Victorian buildings, it was a place of grandeur once. And like everything, it's cyclical. There was always going to be a time when it would return to that.
That issue of gentrification, and also you were talking before about local authorities not being so keen to help out. We're seeing this in lots of other parts of London, whether that's in Brixton, whether that's in Hackney, where you've got clubs and bars that have been very successful but are now being told, actually, you've got to close by 11, or you've had clubs that have been closed down because there was one minor complaint about noise pollution. Do you feel that London is at risk of losing part of its soul that made it so great?
I definitely think so. But one has to understand that, you know, the London nightclub scene is massive and growing. I know, as a DJ who traveled the four corners of the world, there's no place more for 18 to 13 year olds would want to be than in London, just to experience the nightlife, the culture, the arts, the music, the food. It's a fantastic place to be young in. And the powers that be are in danger of eroding that or closing it, losing it for the sake of money. Because let's face it, that's what it's fundamentally about. You know, if you've bought a £2 million, £3 million house in Notting Hill or Brixton or Peckham, of course, you really don't want that dark baggage that comes with it. But in certain cases, you would, if you bought a property there, you'd have bought it knowing you'd have come there and met that. So you've no real reason to complain, though I do sympathise, I do empathise with them. I know from my own experience at Notting Hill, you know, I've got friends that live in basements. You know, I used to have family many years ago that used to live in basements. And on a carnival weekend, on a Tuesday morning when the hordes have gone, you really don't want to be the person that goes down there and clears up that crap. And the smell of urine and rubbish, you know, and you're living in, working in a very expensive royal borough, and you're paying top rates, you really don't want to be paying for that.
In your experience, you mentioned you're sort of travelling the four corners of the globe. Is it a question of looking for inspiration elsewhere? Is that what London and Londoners should be doing? Where do you look? Are there other cities around the world that you think manage to strike this balance maybe better than how London
does? No. In my experience, there's no city that strikes that balance, that comes anywhere close to what London offers. Yeah, I'm a patriot. London born, bred, clubbed here all my life.
So even with these problems, it's still
the best. I mean, it's what I call a first world problem, you know, with so much else going on, you know, with people who are far less fortunate. You know, it's great we can sit around here and talk about the potential demise of London Clubland. You know, it's a huge economy. It employs so many people. It attracts so many creative people. It's a necessary part and a functioning part of London and indeed UK culture. It's a fantastic place to be.
When you talk about London now, you still sound enormously positive about the city. Do you still think that, you know, in 10, 20 years' time, people will still see it as that beacon that you've just described it as?
Well, I don't really, you know, my whole life, you know, I've never looked that far. ahead because, you know, tomorrow is promised to no one. But while it's here, you know, we live, we exist in the now. Let's enjoy it and embrace it now. You know, if someone decides to pull the pin, it could all end for everybody. That's what I mean about shifting the focus away from, you know, 10 or 20 years time. It's here and now.
But do you think we sort of moan about these things too much? You said before it's a first world problem. It's like, you know, oh my God, some clubs have closed down. Do you feel we get a little bit too precious about it?
On occasion, but you know, that's just the nature of the beast. It's here. You know, we created it. It is. It's one of the few things in this country that is the envy of the world. Other businesses and huge conglomerates make those claims. But I know from, you know, just general club culture, you know, all other places around the world, yes, in America they have great festivals, or in Europe they have great festivals, or one club. But one club does not a scene make. Here, you know, we have a thriving, you know, even when I was growing up, we had a thriving fanzine culture, which you never found anywhere else in the world. We had a thriving pirate radio culture, which you never found anywhere in the world, given the fact that the broadcasting medium is so tightly controlled and regulated. There's no way you could have, in America or Australia, a pirate radio. You know, my background was in pirate radio. That was my platform. You know, I was one of the originators that created Kiss FM when it was a pirate back in the early 80s. So I'm speaking from personal experience. And it was the platform for a lot of very creative musical people of my generation to hone and learn their broadcasting skills. Mm. You know, we were enthusiastic record collecting anoraks and nerds who loved music. And we just wanted a platform to share that with people. Now, you know, we have a multitude of platforms, you know, thanks to the internet.
A lot of people talk, I mean, we're often talking about magazines and stuff here at Monocle, and we talk about, yeah, the internet is democratizing, and that's amazing because it means that, you know, everyone can be a journalist. Mm. I guess it's the same in a way with music, with the club scene, with DJing. You know, everyone can have a go. Mm. Now, yeah, that's very democratic. Yeah. That's positive. Is that a good thing, I don't know, as an artist, or do you sometimes think, yeah, do you know, these people would be better off if they had a bit more guidance? They're maybe not learning their craft because suddenly everyone's an expert and you can just be out there straight away.
Sure, but there is that. But then, you know, how do you re-educate people who are used to using shorthand in texting? You know, language evolves. Everybody wants or uses a shorthand to something, I guess. And I'm presuming now that, you know, you guys have gone to university or something or gone through a learning process. Nowadays, it's about the instant gratification. You press the button and you're an expert. Nothing wrong in that. But the fact is, I learned it longhand. You can't unlearn that. Mm. It's easier to learn new tricks than it is to forget old ones. So, you know.
Isn't that longhand learning, isn't that always better?
I think so. In the fullness of time and life, yeah, definitely. But I think there's room for it all. Like you said, you know, we kind of live in this democracy, inverted commas, where everything is perceived to be equal, but in actual fact, it's not. The perception is the reality, but it's not. There are some that are more skilled than others, I guess. That's just the way it is. You know, some people will benefit from that and go on to great things, and others will be destined, you know, to remain in their bedrooms. And some are quite happy to remain in their bedrooms, doing that in the womb of wherever they live, wherever they work. You know, I personally, from a personal point of view, I think it's great. At least, at the very least, all one wants is the opportunity, however it presents itself, a fair crack of the whip, a fair chance. Whereas before the technology, it didn't allow you to do that.
Norman, we're almost out of time,
sure.
But before we go, let's. I know you said you don't like to look to the future, but I'm sure you'll make an exception in this case.
Yeah,
What have you got coming up? What should we be looking
well,
out
for? Well, in the short term, August the 29th, Carnival weekend, Good Times Goes East at St. John's Church in Hackney. Really looking forward to that. It's an amazing space. It starts at 4 in the afternoon till 11 at night. That's the major thing that I'm playing up.
So you are escaping Notting Hill for Carnival.
Absolutely, yeah, in real time too. And forthcoming micro album, compilation album, Good Times, Boogie and Skank, about the CD and album. There'll be vinyl as well. That comes out 1st of October. So really looking forward to that. And that's my first compilation project in about 3 years. It's a mini compilation. So I'm going to do a full double pack next year. But this is just to put my toe back in the water.
Norman, actually, I've had another thought. You can't let a DJ of your standing join us here in our studio and not ask you to sort of turn the table somewhat and get you to select a track for us. So do you have a little musical recommendation we can listen to?
I guess one of my heroes has been touring the festivals in the UK all season. Nile Rodgers, no less, and Chic, Good Times.
That was The Wonderful Good Times by Chic, featuring, of course, the brilliant Nile Rodgers. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
We should have breakfast together, and lunch, and coffee, and cake, and a forced beer, or even an Aperol Spritz at sunset. And we know just the perfect spot. Come and join us at our London cafe that's just around the corner from our Midori HQ and also close to the Monocle shop. While you have a great flat white made with all-pressed coffee, you'll no doubt bump into one of our team and get to hear all the latest from the Monocle world. You can also pick up the latest issue of the magazine. Oh, and we also have space for hosting private lunches and events too. Join us at 18 Chilton Street in London and also at our outpost in the Hankyu Men's Department Store in Tokyo. We look forward to seeing you.
And you're back with the Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards. Now, we said we would bring some of the sounds of the summer on the show today, and true to that, we are now turning our attention to the oceans. Now, to outsiders firmly grounded on land, surfing only looks like a sport. To those who are devoted to the waves, however, it is much more than that. A passion that comes from a unique connection between man and nature. You might call it a spiritual experience.
Acclaimed author and writer for the New Yorker magazine since 1987, William Finnegan is also a surfer. His new book, entitled Barbarian Days, A Surfing Life, could be called an adventure story, an autobiography, a social history, and much more besides. It is, perhaps above all, an attempt to open up the mystifying, dangerous, an often misunderstood pastime that is surfing. A little earlier, Robert Bound joined me, and we heard from William Finnegan from New York. William, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. Great to speak to you. Let's start maybe with the waves, appropriately enough. They're so often the kind of the stars of this book. You write so eloquently about the waves themselves. It does seem you have an almost, I don't know, encyclopedic memory of almost even individual waves. Is that what the experience of a surfer is like?
No, it's not. It's very hard to remember individual waves. You'll often come in from a session where you've surfed 10 or 20 or 30 waves and you can't seem to remember a one. I think what you get from my book, there are lots of waves described and rides described, but those are primarily drawn from, you know, journals I kept at the time or letters I recovered from friends where I came in and sort of frantically wrote descriptions of waves I'd just had, but they're actually very hard to remember. You end up remembering your description more than the things themselves.
And did you keep a journal, William, of all the stuff as it happened? I mean, I'm always interested in this. Your memoir is a long and detailed one. Were you looking at waves, surfing those waves, and thinking, this reminds me a bit of this? Or did you crash on the beach after a session in the surf and write down some sort of big, nice adjectives in your notebook?
Not really so much. I mean, I kept voluminous journals, especially when I was younger, and yet they're not so much about surfing. I mean, they're all, you know, agonies about girls and whatever was on my mind, books I was reading. But as I said, I recovered a lot of letters from different periods of my life when I was surfing quite intensely, often letters to friends who surf, and those have got the really detailed descriptions. But it is true that in the water, you're constantly referring, as you try to sort of read the waves, figure out what they're doing, you are constantly thinking about other places, other waves, other days at the same place as you try to understand what the ocean is doing. That's what you're mainly doing out there, is trying to understand what the ocean is going to do next.
William, I wanted to ask you, I guess on a sort of similar literary theme almost. In the book, you write about buying these old editions of the New Yorker, and we mentioned in our introduction, you've been writing for the New Yorker for, you know, many years now. And I wondered, I don't know, you sort of write about how you were reading them and consuming the stories inside. Was that, I don't know, an element of destiny? Did you sort of feel you were always going to come back to that? Was that something that happened whilst you were traveling the world?
There is that strange sort of feeling of destiny about that episode in particular. I describe when I was young and sort of bumming around the world surfing, landing up in Australia with a friend, also a writer and surfer, and we'd been in the South Pacific. And at some point, I bought a lot of secondhand New Yorkers for him. We were both fans of the magazine. And I think each kind of secretly keeping journals of, you know, a letter from Queensland, a letter from wherever we happened to be, thinking we might like to write for the New Yorker. But we had those old magazines, and we used to read them to each other, sort of driving across the outback in Australia and putting each piece of work, poem, story, essay, to the what we call the outback test, see how they stood up in the harsh light of the desert. And it's true that maybe 10 years after that, both of us, my friend's name is Brian DeSalvatore, both of us ended up writers for The New Yorker.
And, I mean, in the book, William, there are, as you said, there is this outback test, which is a stern and nicely realistic test for the floridity, perhaps, of certain levels of writing in The New Yorker and other magazines. I wondered if so many cliches are ascribed to surfers and whether you feel that with a book like this, you can redress that balance, that people think there's an idea of the slacker or it's all about sort of grass skirts and the Beach Boys and things. Is that something that you'd kind of like to address with this book? Or do you think that that's probably already happened with some of the surf films and the way that surf culture has changed in the last, say, 15, 20 years?
No, I think there is still that strong stereotype of slackers, which has its basis in reality, and of kind of fun in the sun. I don't know about hula girls, but the fun in the sun image, that idea that one has just sort of glancing down the road, seeing some guys out in the water, is quite inaccurate, I mean to say. That is to say, it's the reality is quite a bit harsher, generally speaking. You're out in the water, trying to figure out what the waves are doing, often struggling, and there's this kind of constant battle between people for waves at more crowded spots, the better waves, and battle with yourself to figure out what's going on and to do better. And there's a lot less laughter in the water than you might think, and a lot more kind of serious. It'd be pretentious to call it intellectual work, but this struggle to read waves is really what everybody's doing out there.
And there is that. There is the look that you have on the beach when there is a collegiate feeling, but you kind of want to be the person to go out and catch the best wave. You're looking at the swell. You're looking at how the water is behaving out there. You make a certain face. There is a surface squint, right? The way you are scanning the horizon and the water near you. Is that something that people kind of think you're in some sort of trance and you have to apologize and say, oh, sorry, I was just surf watching?
That does happen a lot, yes. In fact, I was being interviewed on the beach the other day and there were some good waves coming through, for radio no less, and I kept getting distracted and say, oh, look at that, you know, and no, look over here, listen to what we're talking about. That does happen, and it's something that non-surfers, I think, often don't get. You know, what are you looking at? There's nothing going on out there, but there always is, of course. And
I mean, in that respect, I wanted to lead on to your work as a foreign correspondent and being sent all over the world on amazing assignments for The New Yorker and using your language, using your reporting skills for not necessarily more, well, maybe more serious subject matter, but none more rich subject matter perhaps than the waves and the way that man behaves with nature and all the rest of it. Did you use the same sort of journalistic skills of memoir and reportage for reporting on war zones as you did to report on waves?
Well, yeah, it's weird. I mean, this is a memoir, and it's quite a weird genre for a reporter because that is what I do in my normal adult life. I'm a reporter, and so you end up kind of investigating your own memories. You're trying to report out your past, and you've got to go find all these long-lost friends and frenemies, and it's quite an interrogation, you know. You've decided to... It was all private life. It was all off the record, and now you're giving yourself license to depict all these shared, unguarded moments with friends and loved ones. So there's quite a dicey set of decisions to make about what to include and what to exclude and how much to be the journalist and be kind of ruthless about what to put in and how much to, you know, sort of honor the privacy of old friends.
William, I want to ask you about your personal fears, really. And just to, you know, Rob has already mentioned your reporting from war zones, this kind of thing. What's been scarier? I don't know, looking back over your whole life and your professional career and your surfing, is it moments where you suddenly realise that you've lost control, maybe in the ocean, or is a war zone necessarily scarier, or do you not really look at it in those terms?
Well, they're quite different. You know, I've reported from a fair number of countries at war or sort of kidnapping hotspots where you're sort of nervous all the time. You know, something could happen at any time and it's not, you know, heightened except in the odd moments when bullets are flying or something's going wrong at a checkpoint or something like that. But it's you know, sort of never really quite lets up week in, week out in a place like Somalia, for instance, in the 90s I was working there. But in surfing, if you sort of know your way around the water, you know exactly when it's getting dangerous. It's not so vague and random. And when it does go bad, it can get extremely intense. I write about some close calls I've had and stupid things I've done and things I've sworn never to do again in Madeira and Hawaii and some of the bigger waves I've surfed.
And is that the sort of surfers, as self-protective as surfers probably are, as they know the sea so well, they know the surf so well, is there that idea always that before you go in at the end of the day that you want to catch the big one, that you there is always something left for the sea to give you that it almost owes you? Is that when you get into trouble potentially?
Yeah, that could be part of it. It's also just you often don't know from land, you know, how heavy it might get. I mean, you need to have a good long look and sort of time the sets, as we say, and know what your limits are. But you don't know what the ocean's going to serve you up when you're out there. And what you're looking for, that thing you're taking the chance for and you, you know, beat the bushes and travel the world to find, is this very, very intense experience that's right next to a disastrous experience. I mean, that is the real experience of beauty that you're after, is usually just a hair's breadth from, I mean, it's sort of surrounded by violence. That's part of what's so beautiful. I'm talking about just natural violence and the power of the ocean. And so you're trying to place yourself in a spot where you know very well, you know, it could go wrong. And what you've got to judge is, you know, are you capable of dealing with the punishment that the waves can dish out?
And it sounds like we've talked our way around to the title of the book, William, in a way. Just finally, how did you choose that title, Barbarian Days?
Well, the book's a lot of it's about, you know, the sort of struggle to become a responsible citizen in the sort of ancient sense of the word, and this, equally the struggle against responsibility. And in my rather bipolar life, surfing has always been the North Pole of irresponsibility, you know, strange devotion to strange gods, nature worship, and I admire barbarians in principle, but I also, you know, very much want to be a citizen and you know, participate in society, contribute, which in my case means write and have opinions and inform my readers. So this is an attempt to account for all this time spent chasing waves. I mean, I've had this now 50-year very intense surfing life, and it felt like it was time to try to account for that.
That was William Finnegan speaking with Tom and Robert Bound a little earlier. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. After the break, Rob and Tom will have the very tough task of beer tasting. Pour them.
Thinking of starting your own business? Want to make your company a better place to work? Keen to sharpen those ambitions? Or just like some nicer business cards? Well, we know a handsome primer that will take you from fledgling firm to established brand. The new Monocle Guide to Good Business is a 300-page plus book packed with inspirational stories, wise advice, places to locate your new HQ, and of course, great photography and illustrations too. Head to monocle.com to order your copy now or visit any of our stores. The Monocle Guide to Good Business is a book that will show you how to do a job you really love, create a modest dynasty, use your hands and your brain, and even take your dog to work. Come on, it's time for a change.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly with me, Steve Bloomfield, and Tom Edwards. The pitter-patter of near-constant rain, the grey, blustery clouds looming in the sky, and a pint of something refreshing in the garden under whatever cover you can find. Oh, yes, it has to be August in Britain. What people choose to have in that pint, though, is evolving. And once you start to investigate, beer tells us rather a large amount about Britain and its culture.
This week, London's vast Olympia Trade Halls play host to the annual Great British Beer Festival, which is put on by CAMRA, the Campaign for Real Ale. Ale advocates are an increasingly discerning lot. And it's quite a busy battlefield with ales, craft beers and the like. How to make sense of all of these complex choices?
There is only one man fit for this purpose. Author, critic and observer of British drinking culture, a beer expert par excellence, Pete Brown. Sadly, Pete had to come in a little bit earlier when I wasn't around, so Tom Edwards had the arduous task of tasting the beer with Mr. Robert Bound.
Pete, welcome again to the Monocle Weekly.
It's nice to be back.
Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know your way around here now.
Yeah, yeah.
We can have a lock-in and we'll all be able to find our way out.
Excellent.
So you've brought some beers along for us to taste, but tell us about your busy schedule, because you've come in here before to talk about Shakespeare's Local, which is that fantastic yep. book, which charted the history of one pub in Southwark through the centuries, which is amazing. You've got a lot of projects on the go at the moment.
Yes. Publishing is a fickle industry, and even though Shakespeare's Local is my most successful book to date, it's the longest period between books that I've gone through trying to get the next one published. So it's like buses. You wait for several years and then three publishing deals come at once. So I'm currently writing a book about the Great British Pub, a pub about apples and orchards, and a book about the ingredients of beer, what makes beer work.
Okay, so you're going scientific, or at least ingredient-based as well.
I've got a real knack of latching on to non-fiction literary genres about a year to 18 months after they've ceased to be commercial and popular. So I did this with kind of narrative social history. I've done it with sort of comedy travel, and nature writing is peaking just at the moment. So I figure that if I do a book on that now, I'll be able to keep my track record going of getting into a really successful literary genre just as it's finished.
So should we have while we talk about all sorts of things, or talk about the beer festival and the rest of it, should we crack something open?
Yeah, as you mentioned, this is the week of the Great British Beer Festival. The beer that was named Championship Beer of Britain on Tuesday is a beer called Tiny Rebel. The brewer is Tiny Rebel. The beer is called Cwch, which is the Welsh word for hug, or sort of lovely, warm.
The warm embrace.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what we all want.
Which is nice. Yeah. It's what we want from a perfect beer. I couldn't find any of that because it's just won the Championship Beer of Britain.
It's
absolutely like gold dust. But I did bring to start off.
I bet
off
you
with,
saved that for another radio station.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, I was right. Doing that with.
Yeah, cheers, mate. Whatever.
Yeah. But I did bring one of my old favourite beers, Timothy Taylor's Landlord, which I talk about a lot. And there is a link because this beer has won Championship Beer of Britain more times than any other beer.
Has it really?
I can't remember how many
it
is.
Rosettes and cask marks.
But it's it's a.
You can do the serving privileges there. Yeah.
We talk a lot at the moment. You mentioned craft beer. We talk a lot about hoppy beers in craft beers, and people just start to learn that hops are in beer. Well, they're not quite like. So grapes are in wine, but there are a lot of similarities. And people are starting to learn about hops and hop varieties. Before the modern craft beer thing about 10 years ago, this would have been considered a particularly hoppy beer. Mm. And what we mean by that, I always describe hops as like seasoning in beer. If you just fermented grain, which is what we do to get beer, to get alcohol in beer, you have quite a sweet one-dimensional liquid, a bit like sort of a cup of tea with digestive biscuits dissolved in it and a lot of sugars. And we put hops in like you'd use herbs and spices in food, and they give it lots of kind of top notes, aromas, and a lot of flavour as well. They give some really nice, depending on the variety of hops, you get grassy flavours, you get fruit flavours, you get sort of spicy, peppery flavours. And Timothy Taylor Landlord has always had a relatively high balance of hops compared to other beers.
Cheers, by the way.
Cheers.
Yeah, good health.
So there's immediately kind of a fresh...
Oh, so I went straight in and drank it.
Smell. No, you should.
Sure, like a rat up a drain pipe, I am.
Everybody else can just get on and drink their beers. It's my job to talk about them.
It's amazing, as you say, Pete, though, if you consider how hoppy a lot of these craft beers are now, to consider that this would have been a little bit out there, you know, in the previous sort of generation. Wasn't it also Landlord that, sorry to get a bit celeb-y, wasn't this the beer that Madonna kept drinking? And they basically had the opportunity to massively increase their output, but elected not to do it, to kind of stay true to their
sort of brewing principles.
Yeah, very famously. It's when Madonna and Guy Ritchie supposedly drank in the Dog and Duck in Soho, and Landlord still remains their best-selling beer, I believe. The thing about it, and we've got it here in its bottled version, it's more famous on as a cask ale, a real ale, and that's what the Great British Beer Festival is all about, really. And that still has live yeast in the cask, and that's still conditioning and fermenting in the cellar. Those beers are getting easier and easier to keep, but they do require a little bit of skill. Mm. And Landlord is just a bit sort of grumpy. It's just a bit kind of quirky and irritable. And if it's very famous for not playing to the rules, like it'll mature and develop differently in different cellars. And if you put Landlord into the wrong cellar or with someone who's just doing it by the rule book and doesn't really get the beer, it will never taste bad, but it could taste quite ordinary.
Yeah, because I've had this before. I've loved this when I've had it when it's been presumably quite well kept.
Yeah.
And it's in one of our local pubs around the corner in Marylebone, and it's touch and go. Sometimes it's the most delicious drink you can ever imagine, and sometimes it's sort of sour, actually. It's a bit...
Yeah, sometimes it can just be a bit flat and dull. And so if they were to just kind of use their fame to go into as many pubs as they possibly could, you'd start to get quite an average delivery of Landlord for people who weren't that familiar with it. So it's, I think I do like that.
It's mercurial beer.
Well, I like it because it's still, I think things like this go through a phase of being old fashioned and fusty and fuddy duddy, and then sort of find a new, you go from being old fashioned to being retro.
Yeah.
So you get a bit older, and then you're still just as old, but you're cool instead of fogyish. And I love that sort of attention to craft, and the fact that it's not just standardised, and the fact that a good publican has to do something to get the beer into proper condition. Mm. But then there is a demand for... But there's two things happening. One is that we're going to the pub a lot less. The average person now goes to the pub once a month or less than that. Yeah, which is a bit depressing.
That's a sound of disbelief.
Yes. We're not average. But what's happening is when people do go to the pub for that one experience a month, they've got higher standards. They want it to be better and they want something different. If you look at something like Meantime Pale Ale in London, which 5 years ago was a very specialist beer that you could only find in a few places, increasingly now it's becoming my replacement for Guinness. You used to go in a dodgy pub, you didn't really know what to have, you weren't sure of the quality of the beer, you knew that Guinness wouldn't let you down. And you go into an average pub now, and there's a Meantime font on the bar that's selling three Meantime beers, and you know that they're good quality beers, and you know that they're good and flavoursome. So we start to see that average come up, I think.
Where should we go next? Because we need to make sure we get the order exactly right.
Yeah, the other three beers I brought in are more modern craft beers. Some of them were represented at GBBF this week. There's also a new festival. Well, it's in its third year now, the London Craft Beer Festival.
So is this part of the London Beer Festival?
No, it was set up... A lot of people were frustrated that the Great British Beer Festival only serves real ale, because there's a lot of great beer in other formats now.
Cheers, Tom.
And I think... So you could say that this festival was set up as a rival to GBBF. I actually think it complements it really nicely. If you're just a traditional real ale guy, you just go to GBBF. If you're a modern craft beer geek, you go to London.
Do these people like fight? Is this like mods and rockers with it? Are there going to be fights on Brighton Beach about this kind of stuff? Damn, I kind of wish they were.
Sandals at dawn.
Yeah, well, the kind of Hackney hipsters versus the kind of
Well, it's a battle of the beards. You've got both types of beard. You've got new and trendy beards and old-fashioned sort of kinky beards.
I like it.
So tell us a little bit about this one.
This is
from Pressure Drop, isn't it?
Pressure Drop are close to my heart because they claim that they read a pub review that I wrote and then went to the pub and then in the pub decided to quit their jobs and open a brewery. Feel responsible.
Did you ask them after this point how many pints in... It took them. Well, that's it. I'm quitting. I hate it. Okay.
I don't think it took many, but they they set up locally to me. They're just under an arch in Hackney, as many brewers are these days. This is a beer called Woo Gang Chops the Tree. On the last episode of Stuart Lee's Comedy Vehicle, the last series, he did an extended routine about beers with ridiculous names, and he was talking about Gandalf's Memory Stick and things like this. And he was talking about, as a functioning 45-year-old alcoholic, I like these beers with absurd names. And I helped run the Stoke Newington Literary Festival we had, Stuart, last year, so it was only a few weeks after this, and I found a beer called Woo Gang Chops Tree, and I said, Stuart, from one 45-year-old functioning alcoholic to another, this is just to show you that truth is always funnier than comedy. But he really appreciated it.
Yeah, that is probably brilliant. And this is a wheat beer, right?
Yeah, and one of the reasons for bringing this in is to show that, I mean, we've always had the great traditional real ale styles of Britain. We're one of the best brewing countries in the world, revered around the world for our beer styles. And the big change with craft beer in the last 10 years has been that other countries have their beer styles as well. And what you're getting now is this massive international cross-fertilisation. So this is a Hefeweizen, which is traditionally a German beer style, very strictly, very geographically contained, mainly around southern Munich. And you can now get Hefeweizens made in all parts of the world where there's a good brewing culture. So this is a Hefeweizen, German Hefeweizen, made in Hackney under a bridge.
Pete, just on that, we talked a little bit about, you know, this sort of over-hopping and the fact that that's sort of, it's often talked pejoratively about the North American beers. Well, of course, is very overhopped. Is it welcome to have all of these different influences? Do you think it helps the marketplace? People can pick and choose strengths? Or when you get these big sort of, because it becomes quite voguish to have some very, very heavily hopped. We've got a Beaver Town there, some super
hoppy. We better
open
that, because we better open that, we better open that and get on with the
Yeah. Do you like to always see, is any intervention from without welcome in your view?
I think so. You're always going to get good and bad in any scene. We've got great traditional real ales and really boring traditional real ales. With hoppy American pale ales, you get people who don't understand what they're doing, or people who are just kind of a bit too brash. I'm a big fan of super hoppy beers. They changed my life in beer terms. They changed my life as a writer. I think they're absolutely great. But the very best examples, yes, the hops are kind of off the scale, but there's the other ingredients are there in balance as well. Instead of just getting a flash of hop bitterness and then it's gone, you get that lovely hop build-up, and that's the sign of really well-made beer. And this one, Beaver Town, Gamma Ray.
This is one of my favourite pints in a place that's just opened up, well, a couple of years ago, behind where I live, called Smokehouse in Islington. They have an amazing list of beers, and this is one of the great things they've got on tap, actually.
This is just flying now. They started off very small in Haggerston, and then they moved breweries twice to bigger breweries. And now they're just, I think, they've hit their game, both in terms of, I think what you're looking for in craft beer, you want someone who's adventurous and prepared to try new recipes and do new things. But that's great as long as you've got the technical know-how and the sort of high standards and the sort of application of rigorous control. Beaver Town in the last sort of couple of years have really hit that on all levels. You know, they're great technically and they're great creatively, and they're just having too much fun. It's not fair.
There's a lot of, and we can tell our listeners, this is a great, they can probably Google the can and see some of Beaver Town's branding.
I've had some lost afternoons with their neck oil, which is one of my, yes, that's one of my, it's not strong.
Yeah,
but if you drink enough of it.
Yeah,
this beer is great because it's all about those hops, massively floral, lots of tropical fruit, but it's not overpowering. It's balanced, and the nice thing is, after you've had a pint of this, you want another one. You know, the hops haven't destroyed your palate, and that's why I think it's just hit an absolute little groove. And if I get some of this in the house, it just disappears. It's wonderful.
Nice. Go around Pete Brown's house. Sod the Craft Ale Festival. Next week, you're at the Green Man Festival.
Yeah.
But some listeners might have heard the culture show that we did there from last year, where you were matching beers with bands. I remember last year getting heavily into the Perrys.
Yes, yes.
Man alive. And that was about as much as I can remember.
that is the last thing you would be able to remember.
Yeah, it's pretty hardcore. Pete Brown, as ever, thank you very much for your time. Pete Brown, author of Shakespeare's Locals and 4 maybe more books in the next year. We shall see. Thank you for your time, as ever.
Thank you.
That was Pete Brown getting Tom Edwards and Robert Bound very drunk. You're listening to The Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. And that is your lot. That's that, Tom, for edition 319 of The Monocle Weekly. I feel that I missed out on some of the good bits there.
You missed out a little bit. You certainly missed out hearing about the thrills and spills of surfing, and you definitely missed out sampling a few of those fine ales with our good friend our good friend Pete Brown.
At least I can listen to the surfing thing and I can read the book, but the drinking, yes.
But you could just listen back to myself and Rob enjoying those tipples. At least you'd be happy for us that we got to
enjoy. I am happy for you. I'm happy for you that you both managed to sort of get yourself a drink. And of course, you know, we could all pop along to the festival and drink to our heart's content.
That's right.
If we so wished.
And I felt we did what we said on the bottle at the start. That was quite a sun-kissed summery edition of the
Monocle
Weekly. It
was. We had music, we had surfing, we had beer. We had some more music as well.
It doesn't get much more summery than that, in my opinion.
And we also had a slightly dubiously named news look ahead.
That was more problematic.
Yeah.
And not particularly. That wasn't Sunshine Radio from Daniel Dracofelli. That was more, I'd say, overcast to gloomy.
Well, we'll see whether he improves for next week, because Mr. Andrew Tuck is on another holiday next week. So I believe it'll be either you or me with Mr. Robert Bound.
I think I might be in the chair. So yeah, maybe more from Danny. Sorry, listeners.
There we are. On that depressing note, it's all we have time for on the show. It was produced by David Pleasant. The studio manager was Claire Abarn. The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week. But for now, it's goodbye from me, Steve Bloomfield.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Goodbye.